welcome to Inside Education. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. The programme's website is insideed.com, where you can listen to or download podcasts of over 140 Inside Education programmes. A Google search for the term dyslexia will return in excess of 12 million results. A more interesting search for a teacher to do is, what does a page look like to someone with dyslexia? And that will let you see the variety of ways in which dyslexia can affect how you see text. The website of the Dyslexia Association of Ireland, dyslexia.ie, states that 1 in 10 people have dyslexia. But what is the condition? How can it be diagnosed? And what can be done to support learners who have the condition? To answer these questions, I spoke to Erica Doyle, who is a registered psychologist and research fellow with the National Longitudinal Study of Children in Ireland. Erica has lectured in developmental psychology for the School of Education, TCD, and undertakes dyslexia assessments for third level students. Her background is in child development, dyslexia and cognitive testing, and she runs a private practice in these areas and runs parenting courses. Later in the interview, Erica Doyle will tell us about research that she has conducted on young children with dyslexia. But first I asked her to tell me, what is dyslexia?
Dyslexia is a specific learning difficulty. It would be known to be related to reading and spelling, but actually is a broader spectrum of issues going on there, which may be related to, say, organisation, some coordination difficulties, remembering, so memory issues or whatever. And it's not related to schooling, to IQ, or to, say, an illness or a disease, let's say. So it's, if you take all of those things out of the equation, a child still has an issue with learning to read, write and spell. And it's found in, well, depending on the literature you look at and the language you're using, in maybe 2 to 10% of the population. So you would expect to have maybe 1 or 2 children in every class who might be struggling with reading, writing, spelling.
And what age can it typically be diagnosed at?
Well, tests can't really be used until the child is starting to fail to read, unfortunately, because obviously that's you know, where you're starting to see the real issues come through. So probably around 7, but there would be early indicators. So there might be things where a child is failing to get the alphabet, maybe at the same time, maybe as a sibling might have or whatever. So testing usually, if a parent has no experience of dyslexia before, and then is starting to see maybe their child struggling compared to the peers, compared to the children in the classroom at around 7, 8, 9, you know, they should be clued into maybe getting an assessment done, definitely talk to the teacher and see what can be done. Usually they'd be referred on to the school psychologist, and there may be a waiting list, unfortunately, and then they would be sent for an assessment. An assessment is usually broken down into 2 areas. One would be an IQ test, and then the other would be tests around reading, writing, math skills to see if there's a discrepancy between the child's ability, because it's not to do with the child's ability, it's about their performance, and you know, how they're performing, say, on a little reading test or writing test or whatever. If there's a big discrepancy, and it usually would be around, say, maybe a severe issue would be 2-year delay between themselves and their class peers. Obviously, there's a major issue going on there, but there can be smaller discrepancies that could start to be worked on and remediated.
And to what extent, Erica, does it continue in families?
It's thought that there is a genetic predisposition, so there is a heritability. Research is still ongoing, and they think that perhaps 50%, up to 50%, twin studies in the States, in Colorado, have looked at you know, heritability between twins in the same family, or twins who have been brought up separately, and it looks around 50%. Other people have looked at the data again and maybe revised it down a bit between, say, 35 to 40%. So, say, if a parent has dyslexia, there's a strong chance it may come through in one of the children, not necessarily all of the children. So that should be something to be aware of.
And apart from the genetic factors, are there any other causes of dyslexia that we know of?
Well, that's part of the problem with dyslexia. It's an umbrella term for a lot of issues that may or may not be genetic, or there is a genetic predisposition, but we don't know how it's switched on. So there could be a number of genes coming through now where there, you know, there's a locus on a chromosome that there may be something and they need the mix of genes, but then you might also need the switch. So we don't know if there's something happening in the womb that's switching on this predisposition to a neurological issue. So it could be something like toxins, nutrition, some kind of immune deficiency or whatever in the womb that's switching on the gene that then the brain is developing slightly differently to what your normal child would do, and then it's ending up with an issue with maybe reading or maybe just spelling or maybe, you know, a combination of another disorder, maybe with a motor disorder or ADHD. There's a link across the spectrum on some of those disorders.
And do we know enough about any of those potential causes to say to a mother or to parents, you know, that they should watch their diet when they're pregnant? Or, you know, do we know enough at that stage to give that kind of advice?
Not really. I mean, there has been some research done in the UK on essential fatty acids, and that's a good thing to do. Well, obviously for everybody it's a good thing to do. We don't get enough omega-3s and any omega-6s. And if a child, say, is struggling a little bit with attention or, you know, reading, that maybe it might be a good idea to give supplements. And there has been some studies done. Seems to be a bit more benefit with children for ADHD, but it's not totally conclusive. It's not going to do any harm. But obviously you're not going to overdose on supplements or whatever as well.
And my perception, and this might be right or wrong, is that it's more prevalent among boys than girls. Would that be right?
Well, that's the perception. The reality, you know, you have to look well into the literature. You know, if you look through, say, from the 70s, some of the work done in the States and in the UK, you see a prevalence of, say, 4-1 male to female. But if you look at the criteria and the selection for the studies, it may be that boys are acting out earlier in class. So teachers are, you know, seeing, OK, there's an issue here, what's going on? So maybe the boys have it more. But some people are saying, well, right, girls are affected as well, but they may be coping for a while. But then when they get into secondary school, they start to struggle. And that's where you see the dyslexia manifesting a bit more. So it's really to do with criteria, and it's also to do with definitions. So it's a very blurry area, but most people feel there is a bit more of a preponderance in boys, and that would be the same for all their disorders.
And can dyslexia be mixed up with other conditions? Like if somebody can't read or has difficulties reading, do you automatically assume or state that, OK, the dyslexia is the problem, or could it be mistaken for something else?
Well, what you do get is a kind of a co-occurrence with things. So speech and language issues are a precursor in some cases. So children under 5 often have speech and language issues, are remediated, and they're fine. If the speech and language disorder continues beyond the age of 5, they're at a higher risk for dyslexia, because obviously they're not laying down the foundations for written language at that stage if they're having problems with phonology or, you know, letter sound kind of connections and that type of thing. So definitely it can co-occur with SLI, speech and language impairment, some ADHD, some children, there will be a co-occurrence, a bit with autism and a bit with dyspraxia type disorders.
And if a child, say, has a speech and language disorder, is there anything that they can do to reduce the possibility of it leading to dyslexia afterwards?
Well, I think really early intervention, early diagnosis, obviously a speech and language issue will be more apparent, obviously, than a dyslexia, because dyslexia comes after. So if the child isn't learning to speak or pronounce well, say, at, you know, coming on from 2, children should be, you know, sent for diagnosis and speech. Once the speech is under control, often that's fine. And it depends on the severities, because the children present with different severities. So I suppose being vigilant, sending on for a diagnosis and treatment, and watching then as they go into school, if they have a history of a speech problem, as they go on to school, flag it with the teacher to say, look, you know, they have had this. I just want to keep a check on how the kind of alphabet and the spelling is coming on, and, you know, keep an eye both at home and at school. And then if there's an issue, say, coming on into senior infants that they're not quite grasping things, then start to raise the flag and start to look, well, maybe there might be a little bit of dyslexia there.
Okay, so if we go on then to our 7-year-old child, Erica, who has been diagnosed with dyslexia and has gone through the, you know, teacher referrals and the dyslexia assessment by a psychologist and so on, what then can be done to help a child with dyslexia?
It'll depend on the severity. Often they may be able to apply for resources in school, so there'll be extra time. They may be able to get time out with their small group teaching or individual teaching. But most practitioners and most people in the dyslexia area feel that extra reading is the key. Extra time around reading, spelling, writing is the key. It'll depend on what the child is presenting with. Some spelling may be an issue, reading mightn't be a huge issue, but writing things down or getting thoughts down on paper. Some of them it might be the handwriting is an issue, some of them it might be a visual stress thing with tracking across the page. So it's a very individual problem, so that has to be sorted out first and see what's going on with the child, and then various things then can be put in place. The Dyslexia Association here in Dublin would have a lot of advice on what can be done for the various age groups. There is software there if you need to work on, say, letter sounds and that type of thing for primary school age. But definitely the phonology is the area to focus on initially. There may be other things around nutrition and maybe movement and that type of thing that could be of use.
And some of the treatment options that are offered to parents outside of school, now I'm thinking of here more so than in school, they can be quite expensive. How can parents be sure that they're spending their money wisely on treatments that they might see advertised?
Yes, and first thing to say is there's no cure. So number one, watch the media. You will see from time to time over the years, dyslexia becomes very popular and there's this thing, oh, cure for this, cure for that. Then things die away again and another 5 years, there's another thing coming up. So there's no cure. But that's not the end of the world. Things can be put in place. There are various alternative therapies and you just have to be careful. Look into the background, look into the research behind the various things and see what's available. Some are quite expensive. Some aren't available in Ireland. So it would be worth seeing what is recommended by both your teacher, your psychologist, if the child is attending one, or by the DAI to see what it would be.
That's the Dyslexia Association of Ireland.
Yes. So some of the some treatments involve, say, remediation of kind of motor or balance problems, and that was the area of my research for my PhD. And some families were travelling to the UK to avail of balance training type programmes, which were quite expensive. Some anecdotally thought that that did help with their child's progress, say in late primary school years, and others, you know, parents are at the end of their tether sometimes if the child has a severe problem, so we'll try anything and everything. So you have to have a kind of a sensible approach to see what is the research behind the various treatments.
You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website insideed.com. My guest on the programme today is psychologist Erica Doyle. I next asked Erica to tell me about her own research and what she set out to study in her study of dyslexia.
We were interested in looking at motor programmes that were used in the remediation of dyslexia because of an article that appeared in The Lancet in 2000. And that looked at reflex movements that could be used to maybe help retrain the brain and help with coordination, hand-eye, that type of thing. And then hopefully help with writing and reading, whatever. Now, it's a good bit step back from what the issue or the substrate problem is, but this was a new idea. We also had heard of another program in the UK, which was to do with balance training, and that was to help train the cerebellum, which is responsible for motor movement, and again, might have an impact on reading and writing. So both these areas were kind of in the news, let's say, both in the popular press and in research. And we decided we'd have a look at that.
And they had been found to be beneficial to children in the UK?
Well, The reflex program, they had seen some benefit of with severe dyslexic children who had been studied in the north of Ireland. And later on in 2003, the balance training program, there had been an article that some children had progressed more in their reading scores, say over a year. But we were a bit sceptical and we wanted to have a look to see, you know, what was going on behind the scenes. Were there other factors involved? So we designed a generic reflex program and a balance training program based on these ideas. And we did an intervention study with nearly 200 children.
And one of the reasons possibly for your scepticism was because the proposed treatment was so far removed from the actual problem, which was the reading problem.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, there, you know, the research is showing that the cerebellum, you know, we don't know enough about what's going on in the cerebellum. It's definitely to do with motor movement, sequencing and timing, that type of thing. But does that relate on a very fine level to things like eye tracking, to things like sequencing sound or, you know, following movement or whatever? And does this, again, relate to reading? Because remember, reading isn't a genetic right that we have. It's something that we have developed as a species, and that, you know, speech, language and being bipedal or up on 2 feet are the things that mark us apart from other species. So the reading part, we think we have an automatic right to be able to read, and in the Western world particularly, because everything's text-based. But if you look around the world with different languages and different cultures, maybe text-based information isn't as important. So going back to your idea of the motor programs, the idea was maybe if the body got better in sync, let's say, maybe the reading and the writing and the spelling would flow. That's the kind of theory. But it's a long causal chain, as you can imagine, between various start and end points.
Yeah, and for people who don't know the geography of the brain, where exactly is the cerebellum?
Cerebellum is right here at the back, at the base of, you know, near the bottom, your neck, where your neck, and it's kind of looks like a, you know, a spongy half an orange size thing here back there, and I suppose people who you know are. The idea would be that people maybe who are quite sporty, quite coordinated and whatever, may also be quite good academically. So, you know, or...
And that's because the cerebellum controls the coordination of movement and then possibly whatever it goes into reading.
Yeah, yeah. So these are kind of like, you know, kind of stories or threads that would be around. So research was done on both areas by obviously people in the field. And there's a feeling that there is... Maybe a contribution by the cerebellum. We don't know enough about it, is the reality of it, and we won't for a while. You know, I mean, research will continue. There'll be fMRI studies and things like that, but it's a slow process. So we were really interested to see whether any of these kind of motor type programs would have any benefit on children who we thought were at risk of dyslexia. Now, the original research was done with age groups between, say, 8 and 11 years, and we wanted to see would it help with the younger children. So could we remediate maybe a child that was at risk, or could we maybe use some of the tests that were developed to be an early indicator? So if a child had difficulty with balance skills or coordination or had a retained reflex, was that an indicator that by the time they start school, maybe they might be struggling with early literacy?
And the advantage of that is that you don't have to wait until they start school and until you see that there's a problem with reading.
To fail to read, in other words. So, yeah, so you don't have to wait that long. The confidence doesn't drop, the self-esteem doesn't drop, so you don't have all these compounding issues on top of the literacy issue.
So what did you do then to try and ask or to answer these questions?
So what we did was we recruited children, and mainly boys, but some girls, into the study where there was a risk of already a dyslexic person in the family. So it could be a parent or could be a sibling. So there had to be a close family already a presence of dyslexia. And so that we would have perhaps that 50% who may go on and develop it. So we did a nationwide call for children, and we used schools and that to try and get that age group. And we were recruiting between kind of 3 to 7 years. And we got initially about 200 people interested. By the time we kind of whittled it down, we had 136 people finishing the programme, because it was a commitment of about 10 minutes a night. for, you know, the best part of a year to do these little programs. It was a randomized controlled trial. So we had the children were assigned different groups. So we had three motor programs going on. One was a balance, one was a reflex, and one was a general movement thing that was to act as a placebo. So it wasn't specifically targeting balance or a reflex. It was like a general movement, just very still kind of gentle movements where the cerebellum wouldn't be targeted particularly, or reflexes wouldn't be targeted. And then we had a delay treatment group, which was our control group, who would be offered the treatment if any of the others helped, so that they weren't going to be left out. They would just act as a control on the timing of it. And we saw we tested the children initially on risk of dyslexia in various areas, and then we saw them about halfway through their programme, and then we saw them at the end. So we wanted to see what their progress was on these various tests.
And what did you find?
Well, we found that the programmes didn't seem to have any effect. There was possible a number of reasons for that, hard to pinpoint. It could be that the children maybe were too young, so developmentally things hadn't settled, so we didn't.
What age were they again?
Between 3 and 7 years. So developmentally maybe we didn't see the kind of hard, severe dyslexics coming through yet. Also, children that age, to try and get them to do something every night, maybe the younger ones wouldn't comply as much, though we did check with compliance as best possible. Also, one of the kind of criteria for inclusion in the study was that they would have some kind of a retained reflex or balance. And we didn't find, contrary to...
What does that mean?
We wanted to see if the children coming in had issues already with balance or reflex, because that's what you would expect from the previous research, so that, you know, dyslexia is, you know, is being caused by one of these issues. And if the children, you know, were showing, say, a retained reflex, which I'll explain reflexes in a minute, that if that reflex was remediated over the course of their program, maybe also the risk of dyslexia might go down. Okay, so but there wasn't a correlation, and similarly there wasn't a correlation on the balance side. So if they were having balance issues, so they couldn't manage balance tasks as well as their peers, did their balance get better over time, and did their risk of dyslexia go down, in other words? So we didn't find that. And on the predictive side, where we thought maybe these tests might predict those, because some of the children did go on to have a risk, could these, say, little balance tasks or phonology tasks or ocular motor tasks, could they predict maybe which children might come out at the end with still with a high risk? They could only predict those who might come out with mild. So they're kind of getting there, but they're not good enough. That was really what we found.
And has anyone else tried these tests with that age group subsequently, and did they get different results?
Not that I know of. Now, the balance type tests would be standard developmental tests that you would use with that age group. So, you know, from, say, about 3 up, you would be the gross motor movements. You'd be looking at, can they hop? Can they stand on one leg for maybe 2 to 5, 6 seconds? Can they walk in a straight line, kind of heel to toe, one in front of the other? So they'd be standard type developmental tests, and you would expect, you know, children to be able to do those across, you know, a range of things now, and it may be nothing to do with a dyslexia at all. The phonology ones can be good indicators. So are they getting their alphabet, their letter name knowledge? Are they recognizing letters, you know, early enough before school? And then things like non-word repetition. It's one of Baddeley and Gathercall's tests, where because English is such, you know, an unusual language and also quite opaque, so you don't get that grapheme, phoneme kind of link very obviously.
Like GH is not obviously F in words like rough or something.
Exactly, yeah. So there's, you know, so English is actually one of the hardest languages to learn in that way. This little test is a good idea of how the children, are they managing to decode? So we were getting them to repeat things like, we started off with very simple things like see, up, to, ah, you know, those kind of sounds. And then we had things like, I'm trying to think, skitty cult. You know, you'd say the word. Now, they're not expected to read it, obviously, because they're too young to read these. But to kind of repeat difficult sounds that they mightn't have heard before. Can they break the sounds down? So those ones would probably have been the best, and that predictors of any issues later on, and kind of what you would expect from the literature, that maybe the phonology is the closest issue going on there, or the closest, you know, issues with that would be the closest predictor.
But in terms of, say, something that would help treat the dyslexia, it seems as if it works for older children, according to the Lancet article, but not not for younger children.
Yeah, that's what we found. Now, my point is that our sample, were not presenting with a lot of reflexes, where in the Lancet article, the children are older, had, you know, really had maybe 2 year deficit between themselves and their peers on their reading, so a severe dyslexia, and were presenting with what they called an ATN, or which is an asymmetrical tonic neck reflex. So this is a reflex that should have left or been integrated into the body, but is still around at that age. And
this looks like a poor coordination of the neck, would that be right?
It is, yeah, well, it is. If you think of reflexes going back to when babies are very young, so we all know what the suck reflex is like and the grasp, you know, if you put your thumb into a baby's palm, you just curl it around it very tight. There are about 70 other reflexes that come and go through the child's development, and things like the ATNR and the STNR and a few of the others develop, say, at the end of the first year into the second year, and should be gone by the time the child is starting to walk and run and whatever. If they're still present, the theory is that they are going to cause difficulty, and they will obviously cause difficulty in coordination, but may also cause difficulty in attending to detail, and obviously then reading and writing. So again, you've got a kind of a step back effect, but they don't know how much of an impact it may have. So that was the theory. The Lancet found that, you know, by remediating that ATNR, the children's reading came on a lot. We didn't find that, but then we didn't get a lot of children presenting in the first place, so we couldn't remediate it if it wasn't there.
And that was psychologist Erica Doyle, who is a research fellow with the Growing Up in Ireland study. That's all we have time for on this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest, Erica Doyle. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.